In this corner, the playboy,
Casanova and Romeo, who consider women as having no value outside of conquest. In this other corner, the independent woman, who finds the playboy an annoying chauvinist. Who will win? But let's ring the bell and let the fighting commence. Sounds like it's time for episode 49 of Pop Art, the podcast where my guest chooses a movie from popular culture, and I'll select a film from the more art classic indie side of cinema with a connection to it. I am your on my half hour host, Howard Kastner. Today, I am happy to welcome as my guest, fellow podcaster Amanda Kirkham, who has chosen the postmodern take on rom-coms Down with Love, while I have chosen the Doris Day Rock Hudson film it satirizes, Pillow Talk, both about the battle of the sexes. To begin, Amanda, why don't you tell our audience something about yourself?
Thank you for that introduction. I am a fellow podcaster, though my current podcasting schedule is a little bit on hold. I usually do the Catching Up podcast with my dad. We have not recorded an episode in, a year now. We had a big 2020, so that put everything on hold. But I do have my blog, hollywoodconsumer.wordpress.com, where I do post about a monthly basis. I've been posting a lot of book-related content, and it's my hope that we are diving back into the Catching Up podcast in the next month or so, now that we're finally settled in our new home. That's the podcast where we watch a bunch of TV that we have been wanting to catch up on, then talk about it, and our current series is Supernatural, which I think has just finished its final season, and we are in season 5. There are 15 seasons, so we have quite a bit to catch up on.
Well, great, and first you mentioned Richard Kirkham is your father, and he has been on the podcast 3 times, once with you.
So. Yes.
So with that, let's get to your selection, and that is Down with Love. First, some information about the film. Down with Love is an American film released in 2003. It was directed by Peyton Reed and written by Eve Allert and Dennis Drake. It stars Renee Zellweger, Ewan McGregor, Sarah Paulson, David Hyde Pierce, Rachel Dratch, Jack Plotnick, Tony Randall, Jerry Ryan, Ivana Milicevic, Melissa George, Dory Barton, and Florence Stanley. The story takes place in the early 60s and revolves around a young woman who has written an international bestseller that says women should give up love, but not sex, in order to become equal to men. But the patriarchy isn't buying it, especially a renowned Playboy journalist who is forced into doing a story on the author. He avoids her for a while, then when he sees her, he pretends to be someone else in an effort to make her fall in love with him, expose her hypocrisy, and put men back on top where they belong. Why did you choose this film?
One, I really enjoy the film. I've got kind of an interesting history with it. I was actually trying to think of something that would be good for pairing with something that you would choose. And I don't know why I was thinking of Pillow Talk, but that was what I was thinking. Oh, well, if we could find something to pair with Pillow Talk. And then I thought, Down with Love, of course.
Well, that's very sneaky and clever. When did you first see it?
First attempt at seeing it was when it was first in theaters. I believe the whole family went. So it was my mom, my dad, my sister and I. Something happened with the projector right at the end when the reveal is about to happen. I think literally the line was, so here's the thing, and then the film just stopped. I think it was that the bulb burned out, so they couldn't fix it immediately. They gave us passes. We never went back and saw it in theaters. When it came out on DVD, we bought the DVD, and then I think my sister lent the DVD to a friend. We never got it back, and this is all before we'd actually finally watched the end of the movie, and we'd enjoyed the first hour and a half that we had watched. Finally, one Christmas, I don't know how it happened, but we all ended up buying a copy of the DVD as a gift for somebody else in the family. So we ended up with 4 copies of this DVD. We finally sat down and watched it. 2 or 3 years for us to finally complete the film.
Do you think it still holds up?
I'm not sure. I still quite enjoy it, but watching it this time around, I was a little bit shocked at how raunchy it is in some places. I think there are a lot of things that are probably not very acceptable by today's standards, but then again, it's also parroting the romantic comedies of the past. I think that the two leads have great chemistry. The film looks great. The music is great. And I think a lot of it's quite fun, but I don't know that it's necessarily correct by today's standards.
Well, we'll certainly get into that. I saw it when it opened. There are things that I do like about it, especially from a technical standpoint. It's quite incredibly well done. And I think there is a wonderful supporting cast. But in full disclosure, I do have issues with the movie, and for me, it doesn't quite work. And we'll get into those eventually. Some of my issues, though, will revolve around Renee Zellweger and some aspects of the screenplay, especially at that end when you talk about the big reveal, the big monologue. What are some of your favorite scenes from the movie?
Well, I love the music sequence put to Fly Me to the Moon, where you've got the two different versions cut together with Renee Zellweger and Ewan McGregor getting ready for the date in different ways. I like the phone call, which is incredibly in your face in a lot of ways about the jokes there. I think any scene with David Hyde Pierce, I'm a fan of his. We've actually been watching Frasier. I laugh probably 3 times an episode from just some of his physical humor. Anytime he's on screen doing something, especially that scene where they're in Ketra Block's apartment and he's sitting on the bar and the wall keeps sliding in front of him and he's bopping his head along as the party's going on. I just think he's got a great physical presence in terms of comedy.
One of my favorite lines, I don't know if it's in that particular scene, but it's when David Hyde Pierce tells Ketra Block, "The one thing I have to offer women is the one thing you have to offer women, and that is you."
I think that's a couple scenes before when they're in his apartment, but yes, that's a great line.
I am especially fond of the opening credits with the Saul Bass animation. Thought that was very clever and a lot of fun. I certainly agree with you about David Hyde Pierce. In fact, he was my favorite male supporting performance of that year. Basically, he's playing the Tony Randall character from Pillow Talk, which we'll talk about later. But I also love Sarah Paulson, and I think they have great chemistry together.
Yes, definitely. I love them together on screen.
And I think overall, it has a wonderful supporting cast. Tony Randall is very good in this, and Jake Plotnick as, I guess he's a secretary or personal assistant, but he's the most openly gay character in the show. So it has all these wonderful things about it. I think the strongest aspects of it are the technical aspects, the costumes, cinematography, the art direction. How do you feel about those?
I absolutely love the way that the film looks, and I agree. I think that that's one of the strongest thing that the film has going for it. I had commented when we were watching it the other day, I said, I love the costumes. I love that little sequence where they walk into the restaurant and they're both wearing coats and then they take off the coats and their outfits are mirrored. Sarah Paulson's wearing a yellow jacket and then she takes her jacket off and it's a plaid outfit underneath. Renee Zellweger's the opposite. So the costumes are great. The sets are really well done. It's got a nice glossy look to it. It's interesting because it does a lot to try to look like a film from the 50s or 60s where it's a little bit staged. I feel like sometimes now you watch films from way back when and you can very much tell that they're done on a soundstage, but it kind of leans into that. And I think that's one of the things that makes it work. I just love the style, the colors, everything pops. There's a scene at the end when Ewan McGregor's standing in front of the elevator and he turns around and the elevator's doors are bright blue and they're perfectly matched to his eyes. And it makes him look very beautiful.
This is the one area where I think it works strongest when it comes to postmodernism, because this is a postmodern take on these kind of films from the late 50s and early 60s, in which they're not just commenting on it, because the clothes and the sets and everything are exaggerated to some degree to really emphasize we're talking about fashions from this era, but they're also enjoyable in and of themselves. Postmodernism is where you try to have your cake and eat it too. And here, I think they succeed. They succeed in both commenting on the films at that time, letting the audience know that they are commenting on that time, winking and nudging the audience, while at the same time being very successful in and of itself without having to reference those times as well. When it comes to things that don't work for me, and I think this is one place where we're going to have a big disagreement, I'm sure you'll be commenting on this. I think there are two basic issues with the film that don't work. One has to do with some aspects of the screenplay, which we'll get into later. But the other one is Renee Zellweger, who I believe you said you like very much. I think she's the main problem. I don't think she quite fits in. Even at the time, I was talking to a friend about it, and he said, "Who thought that we'd be looking for Doris Day to come back?" I'm not sure why. I think she's a wonderful actress. She was so brilliant in Judy and Chicago. She is a very, very good actress. And I think someone pointed out that it was her diction, and I think I agree with that. Her diction seems totally wrong for the kind of character that she's playing. And I don't think she pulls off the big monologue where she reveals what's really going on. Now, I'm not sure it's her fault that she doesn't pull off the big monologue, because I think that's problematic in another way. But for me, she was always the big issue. But I know that you love her in this. I think you said that you did.
Well, I really like her and Ewan McGregor together. I will say, this time watching the monologue, I did think that's a lot of info dumping in one scene. I guess we'll get into the script in a minute. I think that she works better in the moments when she's being a little bit more modern in her thinking and her approach to how women should be viewed. The times when she's a little bit weaker is when it's the more traditional falling in love side of her. You know, the whole idea is behind why she actually writes the book. I can see maybe where you're getting at, that she's a little bit weaker there. I really like the opening sequence with her coming to New York. I think that she's cute as a button there. I do think that, and again, it could be an issue with the screenplay, with her playing these two different types of women, the very wide-eyed, new to the city, innocent person, but then also she's supposed to have all this wisdom about men and how they work and how they're in the workplace. And it's so funny that you mention Judy, because we get a sequence with Judy Garland in this, and I completely forgot that she was in Judy recently.
Right, and that actually is Judy Garland singing that song on the Ed Sullivan Show. I think you mentioned something that never occurred to me before that does relate to the script. You said this part about her being wide-eyed and innocent to the city, but she's not wide-eyed and innocent. Mm-hmm. We find out at the end that she's actually pretty much from the city. She's lied about who she is. So this idea of being so wide-eyed and innocent, I'm going, wait a minute, that doesn't really match up to her character. And I think that that's where something goes wrong screenplay-wise. Mm-hmm. When she gets to this long monologue where she, as you say, info dumps, I'm listening to it. And the second time as well, I'm listening to it and I'm going, what is she talking about? Wait, did I get that right? Do I understand what's going on here? And does this make any sense? And that's the last thing you want someone to think about when they're listening to a monologue. Mm-hmm. You want them to instead go, oh, that's very clever. Oh, that's funny. That's hysterical. Oh, I get that. But I'm not thinking that. I'm going, wait, what? She did what? And then this what? And things that really aren't very logical, even for a comedy, especially a comedy of this type. This is a parody of a fairly realistic type of movie. It also changes the Battle of the Sexes types of movies made in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. Because instead of being like Doris Day in Pillow Talk, who is, yes, she would like to be in a relationship, but she has this whole other life going on for her. And she's not actively pursuing a man. And she's not actively pursuing Rock Hudson in Pillow Talk because she has no idea who this person is. And that's true of all movies at that time. They're not about women who are actually pursuing a particular man. This is about a woman whose only goal in life is this man. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, you've totally misunderstood all these movies that have come before. If it had been different, say that it started with her as Ewan McGregor's secretary, and she was dumpy and not particularly attractive. Ewan McGregor then fired her. And she decides to get revenge on him by turning herself into this glamorous author. Her goal isn't to write a bestseller. I mean, she says, I'm going to write a best-selling book. I'm going, you can't write a best-selling book. You can write a book and hope it becomes a bestseller, but you can't do the other way. If she then turns herself into someone to try to seduce Ketcher and turn the tables on him, that's much more realistic. So, you know, I've been info dumping.
I do agree. And probably part of why I might enjoy the film so much is because that first viewing, the point at which the film stopped was when the flight attendant showed up in the apartment and then left. I might have a memory of this being better than it is because I only saw the first chunk of it. The ending is very convoluted, and this time around I was going, that's a lot to take in. But at the same time, is that supposed to play on the idea that you have these outlandish circumstances in these kinds of films? But I do think that there's something interesting to the idea about how it's all set up, that she's been driven by her love of this man, that usually in these types of films, it would maybe be the plot that you were talking about, where if she had worked for him, he had scorned her, and then she had wanted to go out for revenge. The ending gets it messy. You mentioned postmodernism is having your cake and eating it too. I think that they try to do that with this. They try to have the funny reveal, but then also have it be a little bit, flight attendant comes back and says, oh my gosh, you've hired me to do this and this and this about my life. She has this realization of, oh my gosh, I'm now not just pursuing the man that I love, but I've become a symbol for all these other women. I need to pay attention to that. And suddenly I'm this different person. So they try to have that in as well with the romantic storyline tied up. I do think that the ending is messy, almost like they weren't quite sure how to end it.
I think you may have a point there. The idea of having your cake and eat it too, I think they got the cake, but they weren't able to eat it as well. I do in many ways like the very ending, because that does ties up to romantic comedies of the 30s, 40s, and 50s, in which the basic premise is you have the alpha male and the alpha female, or the superman and the superwoman, who meet. They don't like each other at first, then they fall in love, then something happens to break them apart. What has to happen, the superwoman has to be knocked down off her pedestal because she's too high up. And it's very odd, because that Superman loves her because she's a superwoman and on this pedestal, but she does have to be knocked down off the pedestal. In return, the Superman, in order to win her back, has to make this huge, gigantic, romantic gesture. And that's what we have here, basically. At the very end, Ewan McGregor makes this gesture by saying, I'll work for you as your assistant. I'll take the pay cut. I'll do anything. I'm in love with you. So it does end the way those movies tend to end. It just has this weird little part that doesn't quite work.
And I agree with that. It's kind of interesting. It's sort of the part from her big monologue in his apartment to about when he comes in for the assistant interview. Maybe there was something that they could have done there that was a little bit different that would have made it a little bit tighter there at the end. But for me, it's not as big of an issue, because I quite enjoyed the first two-thirds of the film quite a bit. And I do like the ending where they go back and forth with, you know, who's scooping who.
Right. Another aspect of the film that I thought was a little odd, and I couldn't quite figure out what they were trying to do, and that was the scene with David Hyde Pierce and Sarah Paulson, where Sarah Paulson says, well, I realize that you're gay and in love with Catcher Block, but that's okay. That's no reason why we can't get married. Anyway, and then David Hyde Pierce says, no, I'm not gay. And he's not. In the film, he is not. Jack Plotnick plays the gay character. And I think they were trying to make some sort of comment on these 50s films. But I wasn't sure what it was. And now that we know today that both David Hyde Pierce and Sarah Paulson are both openly gay and in relationships are married, it actually makes it even odder.
I was thinking about that when I was watching the scenes between them. I was going, this is kind of interesting. They're both openly out at the moment. And I had to look it up because I knew that David Hyde Pierce hadn't opened when the film was made. I couldn't remember if Sarah Paulson had. And I think she was technically in a relationship at that point, but didn't officially discuss her sexuality until a later interview. There was a little bit in the storyline that I'm sure they were trying to answer in that scene with revealing that he was cooking at Catcher's apartment and that he made the mistake of saying that the picture was Catcher's parents instead of actually trying to lie about it. It's almost like, again, they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. They wanted to comment on things, but also not comment on things. You do get the assistant, who is the only openly gay character, and then you get these other comments. None of that's a main storyline, and none of it is really, I feel, developed very deeply. It's all surface level, a little bit trying to comment on it, but also not trying to comment on it.
Right. It should be noted that the movie was not a success. Mm-hmm. It was not exactly a flop. It did make its money back, but not anywhere nearly enough to make it a success. And in fact, it was more of a success with critics than it was with the public. There may be a couple of reasons for that, some that we've mentioned. But I think also one of the issues may have been that often when we see satires or postmodern takes on films like this, there are genres that are still very, very popular. Down with Love is satirizing not just a genre, which is rom-com. They're satirizing a sub-genre of rom-com. You know, I'll mention this again with Pillow Talk, but it's what I call sophisticated comedy. And it was a type of comedy that lasted about 5 or 6 years, the late 50s to the early 60s. It was a transitional kind of romantic comedy where they were trying to be a lot more open about the sexuality and what was going on here, yet at the same time always ended with very bourgeois morality. no sex until they got married. In fact, these kind of films in the late 50s, early 60s were called sex but no sex movies. They were on the beginning of the women's rights movement, the women's empowerment movement. So they were taking a look at what the place of women in society. But once Annie Hall comes along, these kind of movies pretty much disappear. We're no longer about the Superman and Superwoman. We're about the beta male and beta female and the neurotic male and the neurotic female to become the basis for romantic comedies. So it's basically satirizing or analyzing a subgenre of a type of film that lasted maybe 5 years. And I'm not sure the audience cares. Most of them have probably never seen a Doris Day movie in their life. So they didn't have the audience for it that they thought they were going to have.
I think that's probably right. I go to the movies all the time. I see a whole bunch of different things. Of course, I was going to end up seeing this because I'm a Renee Zellweger fan. I'm an Ewan McGregor fan. I like romantic comedies, but even I didn't really understand what it was referencing until much later. And absolutely, that would have an impact on the success of the film. It's not quite a straight romantic comedy. The early 2000s romantic comedies were very different. I don't remember a lot of the marketing. When I saw it, I feel like it was something that I felt was made for people like me who like movies, who like the glossy look that they were going for, who like the style of the 50s and 60s in terms of fashion and music. But like I said, even I wasn't really aware of what it was referencing, especially when I first saw the film. So I could definitely see how that would have impacted how it was marketed and how it was received by people who just didn't know what to do with it.
I have a quote by Roger Ebert, who questioned the point of The Exorcist, and he compared it to Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven. And I agree, it would be an interesting movie to compare to Far From Heaven, which is doing some of the same things. It's trying to get into the subtext of what it was saying about society and men and women at the time. He compared it to Todd Haynes' Far From Heaven, which he says plunged into the subtext of those old movies, whereas Down With Love, being an updating and a critique, snips the subtext away, actually making it less sophisticated than what it imitates. And I think he does have a point. And I think even at the time, I compared it to Far From Heaven myself. Far From Heaven is a far more successful attempt at trying to figure out what these films were saying about society at that time. I'm not sure what Down With Love is trying to say about men and women in the late 50s and early 60s, or what it was trying to say about society as a whole.
I don't think I've seen Far From Heaven. I do agree that there's not quite sure if they're trying to comment on men and women from the 50s, men and women from the early 2000s, or just the kind of film. I wrote a paper in college on it, actually, for a class that I had that was focused on movie musicals. The prompt was something to the effect of choose a movie that's not a musical and explain how you would make it a musical. In a lot of ways, Down With Love feels like a musical without musical numbers.
I think that's a very good observation.
So maybe there's something there that in the way that it's structured, it feels like you should have a musical number. Both Ewan McGregor and Renee Zellweger are singers and dancers, or they have been in musicals before. Maybe it would have worked a little bit better if it had been actually made into a musical rather than just a straight rom-com.
I do agree that some of it is extremely funny. The screenplay by Eve Allard and Dennis Drake. There are just some wonderful one-liners and zingers. The supporting cast, well, they have all this wonderful dialogue. And Peyton Reed, who might seem like an unusual director for this, does a very solid job. He does go on to do Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I find very enjoyable entries in the Marvel Universe pictures.
We actually just watched Ant-Man the other day. We're working our way through rewatching the Marvel series. I laughed every 5 minutes in that, and you get good comedy from everybody, not just Paul Rudd. Everybody in it is funny. There are a lot of visual gags and a lot of good one-liners, and I didn't even make the connection.
That's what IMDb is for, because I never would have made the connection either. But yes, he does a very solid job of directing. With that, here's some more information about the movie. As I said, the movie was not a real success. It cost $35 million to make and made only $39.5 million. It probably would have had to make $55 million to be considered a real success. During the dating montage, one of the scenes in the background is of a man playing the bongo drums. This footage was taken from the scene in Pillow Talk when Doris Day and Rock Hudson's characters first meet. This was the final theatrical movie of Florence Stanley. She plays the dry cleaner's wife in the film. She is perhaps best known as playing Bernice Fish, Fish's wife on Barney Miller. Will Jordan, who played Ed Sullivan, made a career of playing Ed Sullivan. And not only did he do it in Down With Love, he did it in Mr. Saturday Night, The Doors, Elvis, The Buddy Holly Story, and I Want to Hold Your Hand. Talk about typecasting. And the song Here's to Love, which is sung by Zellweger and McGregor during the closing credits, was a last-minute addition to the film. It was added as a suggestion of McGregor, who pointed out that since both he and Zellweger had been in two of the most popular musical films most recently, Moulin Rouge and Chicago, that they probably should have a number at the end for the two of them. So songwriters Mark Shulman and Scott Wimmen, who appear in the number as the bartender and the pianist, then wrote this number for them. And I agree with them. I think it does make a very nice ending to the film.
Yeah, I definitely like the musical number at the end. And again, like I said, the whole movie could have been a musical.
Well, with that, let's get to my selection, and that is Pillow Talk. First, some information about the film. Pillow Talk is an American film released in 1959. It was directed by Michael Gordon from a screenplay by Russell Rouse, Maurice Richland, Stanley Shapiro, and Clarence Green. It was produced by Ross Hunter. It stars Rock Hudson, Doris Day, Tony Randall, Thelma Ritter, Nick Adams, Alan Jenkins, Marcel Dalio, Lee Patrick, William Shallard, and Perry Blackwell. The story takes place in 1959 New York City, where there are so many requests for telephone installations, many people must share their line, called party lines. Conflict arises with the successful interior decorator who can't get or make calls because her party line partner hogs the phone so he can woo women. When the playboy finds out who the designer is, he decides to make her his next conquest by disguising himself as a morally upright businessman from Texas. Will she find out before they have sex? Well, it's 1959. What do you think? What do you think of the pairing of the two films?
I think the pairing is very perfect, especially considering that Down With Love has so many direct references. And in fact, in watching Pillow Talk the other day, I watched some of the special features and they mentioned Down With Love in the special features for Pillow Talk. So I think the pairing is perfect. I really like the film. I chose Down With Love hoping that you might choose Pillow Talk.
Well, when did you first see the film?
I actually only saw the film for the first time last year. It has a little bit of a special place in my heart because it's the first movie that I watched in our new house. I was here by myself for a couple weeks while my dad was packing up the house in California. Because it was COVID, I got the stuff to set up the cable box and the internet, and you had to do it all yourself. No cable installation person came, and I spent maybe like 6 hours actually setting up the internet and the cable. And at the end of the day, I was exhausted. I didn't have any furniture, but I had my TV and I had my cable box. TCM, of course, was one of the channels Pillow Talk was going to be playing. And so I said, oh, I like Doris Day. I've never seen Pillow Talk. I want to watch that. One of the first nights that I spent in my new house after setting up my cable, that was the first movie that I watched.
And what did you think of it? Sounds like you very much enjoyed it.
I did. I don't know how I got it into my head that I was a big Doris Day fan, because in preparing for the show today, I realized I've only seen two of her movies, Pillow Talk being one of them. So when I saw Pillow Talk, it was only the second film that I had seen with her in it. The other one is Calamity Jane.
Okay.
I'm also a big Howard Keel fan. I think my appreciation for Doris Day comes from that musicals class that I mentioned that I took in college. My professor was a big Doris Day fan, and I think he showed a lot of clips of her films. But I really like the movie. I think she and Rock Hudson, you talk about great chemistry. They've got wonderful chemistry. Obviously, they made several films together. It's so interesting that we're talking about Down With Love and how some of the things around that film don't necessarily translate. Not just that it might not hold up, but we talked about the marketing efforts and how that's a little bit different than you would have even today. The whole concept of Pillow Talk with a party line. I didn't even know that that was a thing until I watched the movie. I was very confused for the first 20 minutes of the film going, I don't understand. I thought that they were in the same apartment building and that they were sharing a phone line because of that. And then it took a while for me to realize, no, that's not the case. So my ignorance when it came to that particular aspect was a little bit hard for me to get past to then actually enjoying the film. But I think Rock Hudson and Doris Day are wonderful together. It's quite funny. Again, for a film that has a musical star in it that doesn't really feature her singing except in the opening credits sequence and then later in the film with one scene. I did miss that it wasn't.
When it comes to party lines in small towns, it would often be a larger number of people sharing a party line. In the Andy Griffith Show, at least for a while in the beginning, the whole town shared the same line. So that was not unusual. I don't know whether in New York City at the time, whether that would really be a thing. We'll actually find out that originally the movie was first written around 1944. Being World War II, I could certainly imagine at that time, people would have a lot more trouble getting individual lines. I can't remember when I first saw it. I'm sure I saw it on TV sometime in the 60s or 70s. I always get a kick out of it. I think it's a lot of fun. I think it's very much of its time. Mm-hmm. And we'll get into some of that aspect of it. But there is a certain freshness and enjoyability about it. They do have great chemistry. And like Down With Love, it has a first-rate supporting cast. They often knew really how to cast films mm-hmm. in those days. What are some of your favorite scenes?
I really like the scene where he first sees her at the club. She's got that great dress on. There's this inner monologue going on with him. He's already formulated his plan, and it just so happens that they end up in the same place. And I love all of the sequences where they're on the phone together. Their dialogue back and forth is great.
And the split screen, they use a lot of split screen and a triple screen movie.
Also, right after the scene in the club, the scene in the cab where he's taking her back to her apartment, and they both have this inner dialogue going on with themselves. They both want to continue the conversation. I love her reaction to asking if he's married, going, oh my gosh, can't believe we did that. Pretty much any time that they're on screen together is wonderful.
I certainly agree, especially with a lot of split screens and the bathtub scene, which was very risque for the time and did have some censorship problems. When he lowers his foot and she seems to react to it at the same time. Like Down With Love, I love the opening credits where she sings Pillow Talk and they're tossing the pillows back and forth. I love any scene Thelma Ritter is in. I think she steals this movie, but she is one of America's greatest supporting and character actresses. But the scene that I think I like most is the roly-poly scene where they go to the nightclub. It's Perry Blackwell, who played one of the major nightclubs at the time for 7 years, sing this really fun song called Roly-Poly. She knows exactly what's going on and when they're about to leave, and he starts playing, "You dog, you dirty dog, you lied."
That's a great scene because of all of those things. Also, you get Doris Day singing. It's a fun song. And yes, I love that eye exchange between them at the end as he's escorting her out. I'm like, I know what you're doing.
But this was, as I said earlier, a particular kind of romantic comedy. It was a transitional romantic comedy where they were trying to be more open and appealing to the audience, which were becoming more influenced by foreign films, which were much more frank and honest when it came to sex. And in addition, we're about to hit the sexual revolution not very long after this. So they were trying to broaden the audience, get people back into the theater. But it was also called the sex but no sex comedies, because it threatened that these people would have sex. But in the end, no, they had to get married before they have sex. Groucho Marx always had a joke where he said, "I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin." By the time of Annie Hall, this kind of movie was pretty dated, but it is one of the last examples until we get to people like Nancy Myers and Nora Ephron of the Superman and Superwoman. Because in this film, Doris Day is the alpha female and Rock Hudson is the alpha male. And they first hate each other, and then against their better judgment, they fall in love. One of the scenes that gets talked a lot about are the scenes where Rock Hudson pretends to be gay. Rock Hudson would show these films to friends. He would get his friends together. They would just laugh hysterically over this because Rock Hudson was gay. Rock Hudson loved doing this. That, I don't think, is problematic today. What is problematic today was when Doris Day calls Rock Hudson vicious because he accused someone of being gay. That is something that would really be problematic if they did that in a film today. Talking about Doris Day and Rock Hudson, this changed their career. Doris Day went from the girl next door to becoming a sex symbol. And she was a little reluctant to do it at first, but Ross Center said, "No, I see that you can do this. I see this in you. Do it." And suddenly she became this big sex symbol. And this was Rock Hudson's first comedy. So this was a very important film for both their careers. How do you react to the way it portrays men and women at the time? What do you think it's trying to say, or what do you think the portrayal of the sexes and their relationships is at the time in this movie?
I think it's interesting. There's a little bit of implication that she's a little too focused on her career because she's questioning why he would be on the phone with women at 9 a.m., wooing them and singing to them. And they say, well, if you don't know why, then there's something missing. But it's never implied that she needs to give up her career for him. I think it's kind of interesting that that's never a thing that's implied, that either one of them has to become completely about the other. So I like that there's not really a question about her being a successful career woman. I was a little surprised with how blatant it was with some of the sexual innuendo. You mentioned the bathtub scene. That was definitely one where I was going, how did this get past censors? And of course, by today's standards, it would be very tame. But I think it's interesting that it's never outright said that he is sleeping with these other women, but there are very clear indicators. He's got a couch that turns into a bed. The doors are locking and the women all seem willing participants. I think that there's also something interesting about the embracing of the sexual nature of relationships between men and women. I do know that there was a little bit of a transition between the 50s and 60s as to how women were embracing their sexuality, how they were shifting from being viewed as homemakers and having careers. So it seemed to me that this is right on the cusp of that, and that it embraces so many of the later views of the successful career woman, the woman who is perfectly happy to go out with a man, go home with him. And nobody ever comments on the women that he is seeing and looking at them in a different light.
Yes, I think you make some very good points here. There's no real talk about her giving up her career or that somehow she's less of a woman because she has a career. This was, yes, a change in the attitude towards women at the time. During the war, the women worked in the factories. The women did all the work at home where the men were overseas. When the men came home, they wanted women out of the factories, back into the house to give the jobs back to the men. The film industry played their part in this by constantly having films, both comedies and dramas, in which a woman who was trying to be more than just a housewife and a mother, there's something wrong with her, or she had to show that, well, she really shouldn't try to be equal to the men. She needs to come down and marry him, have kids, and go back into the house. And then, yes, in the late 50s, this slowly started to change. You'll see a number of these Doris Day films and other comedies like it, in which the women work, they have careers, and the sexuality is much more open. We joke about the idea of new Doris Day before she was a virgin, and that before they have sex, they have to get married in these films. At the same time, she was quite willing to have sex with him before getting married, before mm-hmm. she caught him. This is often a through line in Doris Day films, where the men try to seduce her, and basically they can't have her until they're willing to marry her. The original ending plan for the film was to have Jan, after using the trick switch to lock the door and then smiling at Brad, shut off the light and say, all apartments look alike in the dark. The implication was they were going to have sex at that moment, but they changed it so that now they show that Ian and Brad got married and are now expecting a baby. So the bourgeois morality of the time was saved at the last minute.
I do actually like the idea of that ending, but I also think it would have been a little bit disingenuous to his shift as a character. He goes from being this ladies' man to he throws out his little black book and he calls all the women and lets them know I'm off the market because he wants to marry her. I guess you could have had that ending still with the implication that something was maybe going to happen with them later.
And it does end with Doris Day does get pushed off her pedestal because Rock Hudson does humiliate her when she finds out that he played this awful trick on her. Mm-hmm. And then Rock Hudson, as you say, starts calling all his girlfriends and saying he's off the market with the hope of hiring her to redesign his apartment. But speaking of the relationship between the sexes, there is also the scene with Nick Adam, who plays this sex maniac who gives her a ride home mm-hmm. from his mother's party. And she has to fight him off in the car. And this was not an unusual way to portray women at the time. Today, this would be a really problematical scene. And not so much that the guy was going after her with such intensity, because that is realistic to some degree. You know, there are men like that. But that she puts up with it as tolerantly as she does, fights him off and says no. But she is much more tolerant, I think, than many women would be today.
Yes, but I agree.
But in the movies at the time, this was a game that men and women played. Men would become overly aggressive, and women would have to play them and manipulate them, fight back, and win out at the end, because they would always win out. They would always finally get the guy to obey.
Well, she treats him basically like a pesky fly. It's interesting. I think you're right. Something like this would not go over well today. I think it's also said how it's played in that in those instances, it was always the woman wins out is always played for laughs. And I think that has a lot to do with making it, for lack of a better term, a successful scene, because he is played for laughs. He is not played as a harasser, even though he clearly is. And she just comes off as being very cool and in control of the situation. Don't even try. You're not going to get anywhere. Just stop it. But I do think that was one of those scenes watching it this time around going, oh, yeah, I don't know how they would do something like that today.
His aggressiveness would be looked on in a very different way today. We'd almost consider it attempted rape if we wouldn't consider it attempted rape. But at the time, that was part of the game that men and women played in movies, the battle of the sexes. But the woman always wins at the end. Rarely ever does the man get away with anything because the alpha women are just too powerful. Alpha women are more powerful or superior to everybody but the Superman. So you get someone like Tony Randall and Nick Adams going after a alpha woman, and they're not going to get anywhere. With that, here is some more information about the film. The first draft of the script was by Russell Rouse and Clarence Green, and they wrote it in 1942. It was not produced, so the writers bought it back in 1945. In 1947, they sold it as play, but bought it back once again 4 years later. Then they finally sold it in 1948 to Aron Productions. And Aron Productions is a company that was owned by Doris Day's husband, Martin Melcher. Although the film was originally titled Pillow Talk, censors fought back about that. It was changed for a while to Anyway, the Wind Blows, but by the time the film was made, they put the original title back in. It cost $1.6 million to make, and it made $26 million. In 2009, it was entered into the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. And I do agree with that. It may not be the greatest movie ever made, but it is in some ways a very important movie in how it looked at this changing times and how men and women related to each other.
And also, like you mentioned, it's the cultural impact in terms of Doris Day and Rock Hudson bringing together such great on-screen personalities, launching or relaunching their careers after into something different. I agree. I think it looks wonderful. You mentioned the title sequence, and I forgot to mention when we were talking about Done with Love that you mentioned it. I love animated title sequences. I love title sequences that are not just the credits over background images. I like when there's something to them, and I think that starts the film off great with the look. It's the split screen, which you're going to get, and again, the colors are popping, and it looks amazing.
I couldn't agree more on that. This did change Doris Day's career, because now she became a very sexy actress instead of the grumpy sword. But she was actually offered the Anne Bancroft part in The Graduate, and she turned it down, and I thought, what an idiotic thing to do. I think she would have been brilliant in that part. It almost screams Doris Day to be in that part. And she never really did anything of any significance after The Graduate, and she soon left acting. The film won the Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay and was nominated for Best Actress in a Leading Role for Doris Day and Best Actress in a Supporting Role for Thelma Ritter, Best Art Direction, Set Direction, and Color for Richard H. Riedel, Russell A. Gossman, and Ruby R. Levitt, and Best Music Scoring of a Dramatic or Comedy Picture. This was the first of three romantic comedies which Doris Day, Rock Hudson, and Tony Randall starred in together, the other two being Lover Come Back in 1961 and Singing No Flowers in 1964. And this is one of those films that has the supporting cast that is often very recognizable today, especially for people who are into films that often go way back. Effie Briest, who plays Nick Adams' mother and is the woman with terrible taste at the very beginning of the film, dates back to The Maltese Falcon, where she played Sam Spade's secretary. William Shallard, who is the desk man at Doris Day's apartment building, perhaps better known for playing Patty Duke's father in The Patty Duke Show. Alan Jenkins, who is the elevator operator, dates back to the 30s, where anybody who watches movies and film noirs recognizes him, often as a bumbling police inspector or a bumbling crook. And Marcel Dalio, who runs the antique shop, dates back to the 1930s. He made two of the greatest French films of the 1930s. He was in The Rules of the Game and Grand Illusion. He fled France with World War II coming on. And perhaps most people today will recognize him as the croupier in Casablanca. In closing out, I asked you to choose a film or two to go with your choice that might interest our audience.
I chose two films. My theme with them was that they were rom-coms-ish, I should say. One is a little bit more on the sex comedy side, and the other is more rom-com traditional. The first one is Wedding Crashers, and I chose both of the films because of the element of not mistaken identity, but secret identity. So in Wedding Crashers, obviously, Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson are pretending to be guests at weddings. And the other one is You've Got Mail, which still, again, has that element to it. It's a remake, an older classic film, The Shop Around the Corner. And it has Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks, who are sort of another version of Rock Hudson and Doris Day, where they were paired together several times. They have great on-screen chemistry. You've Got Mail is one of my favorite rom-coms because it involves books, which I love, and it's very much of its time. It's all of these anonymous chat room kind of stuff that was happening around that time that doesn't really happen that much now, and it also involves bookstores, which aren't really a thing that you have now.
Great. I'm going to choose three. The first is Teacher's Pet, which is George Seton's 1958 rom-com with Doris Day and Clark Gable. Clark Gable plays a hard-boiled newspaper editor who doesn't believe in formal education for journalists. He is asked to speak to a journalism class, but is mistaken by the teacher for a student. When the teacher heavily criticizes that the newspaper editor, the editor decides to stay incognito and take the class, and the two fall in love. The Pink Panther is Blake Edwards' 1963 comedy about a playboy jewel thief and the bumbling French police inspector trying to catch him. I think this is in many ways the epitome of sophisticated comedy at the time. And then finally, as was mentioned, Far From Heaven, Todd Haynes' 2002 postmodern look at soap opera melodramas of the 1950s. This one about a middle-class woman discovering her husband is gay while falling in love with her black gardener. So what is next? What should we be looking for from you?
I hope to get back to the Catching Up podcast, but since I don't have a definitive date for that, I have been posting some videos on my YouTube channel, which also get posted to my blog. I finally have an actual book review up right now. So that's what's currently happening and what should be expected for the next probably 2 months.
That's great. Well, I'll go through my usual litany. I'm a screenwriter and screenplay consultant, so I have a Howard Kasner Facebook screenplay consultation page. I have a blog called Rantings and Ravings, where I talk about issues concerning movies and screenwriting. I've published two books of short stories on Amazon, The Starving Artist and Other Stories, and The Five Corporations and One True Religion. These are sci-fi, horror, and supernatural fantasy short stories. I have published the second edition of my screenwriting book called More Rantings and Ravings of a Screenplay Reader. I'm an amateur photographer. You can find those on Instagram. The previous podcast was with Hollywood hyphenate actor-writer Kelly Campbell, where we discussed Something's Gotta Give and Set in Fear, two movies about female playwrights and their love lives. I will then skip a week and come back with my 50th anniversary episode, where I will be joined by writer-director-podcaster of The Real Short Box, Donald McKinney, who was on my very first show. We will be discussing Revenge of the Nerds and the silent film The Freshman, both about nerds going to college. So with that, Amanda, I want to thank you very much for being a guest on my show.
Well, thank you for having me. It was wonderful to be able to watch these movies again, and I had a really nice time talking to you about them.